I'm Dean of Academic Affairs and Professor of Old Testament at Lutheran Northwestern Theological Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. I've been there for 16 years, so I'm an old hand at it, I guess. I have a wife who sits back over here. Her name is Faith. I live by faith in more than one way. I won't go into other biblical passages that mention faith, but there are some interesting ones. I have two teenage daughters, Tanya and Andrea, who will be out and about. I look forward to our time together. Basically, our format will run like this, is I'll try to have a few things to say for about 30 minutes and 35 minutes, and then we'll open it up for comments and questions. I think that it's important that we talk about some of these things. There are going to be a few bells going off, and maybe on the negative side when some of this stuff gets brought up, because there's a mine or two in here, and so it's very important that we get a chance to talk about some of the things about the God of the Old Testament. And for another reason that's just important, I think, to make sure that our communications with one another are open and clear. I don't want it to be like a situation where a prof went out into congregation to give a lecture, and afterwards a fellow came up to him and said, say, that was superfluous, just superfluous. And the prof, of course, just went with that word and all, and decided to respond in this way. Well, thank you very much. You might like to know that I'm planning to have these lectures published posthumously. To which he responded, say, that's great, the sooner the better. I mean, we can talk like that back and forth, you know, for quite a while here. So let's get the questions out and the comments so that we're clear about what we're speaking. Today, we're going to talk about, just to kind of introduce the topic of the God of the Old Testament, which we'll be pursuing for the next 2 weeks. Tomorrow, we'll try to get inside some Old Testament passages so that I know there are some Bibles back there. We won't need them today, but tomorrow, if you have your own Bible or pick one up on your way in, because we're not going to take a given biblical book and start from chapter 1 and move through it, but we're going to move in and out of all kinds of biblical passages that have to do with the varying aspects of the God of the Old Testament. You know, I think that we take God for granted in so many ways, and the word God slips off our tongues in ways that we don't think about. And I think it's very important to sort of challenge you a little bit on that and to try to get you to think about God in some new and some fresh ways. Because I think that much of the thinking and talk about God in the life of the church is not very true to its biblical roots. We use language like omnipotence and omniscience and omnipresence and immutability and all those fancy 50-cent words to talk about God, none of which is biblical. No one of those words has a biblical reference. And so I think we need to go back and take a look at some biblical passages that will help get out what it is that God is and what God is about in our life and in our world today. By and large, we just assume very traditional understandings of God and just live with them and then work with other aspects of our faith, but don't think and rethink as carefully as we ought what and who God is. Now, let me just give you an idea of what the rest of the week is like. Tomorrow, I want to talk about God and world. Say, we got God, we got world. How do we put God and world together? I suspect that if we were to probe that a little bit, that the primary reference of many of you would be, well, in the words of the Billy Graham hymn, he's got the whole world in his hands, huh? And what understanding of God are you working with, if that's the image? God and world. Talk a little bit about God and space, God and time. Does God have a past, present, and a future? And what are the implications if he does, according to the biblical materials? That's tomorrow. Then we skip a day, because Christmas is on Wednesday. We have to. And Thursday, the presence of God is the theme. Where is God present? Where in the world is God? Where in the world is God? Can one indicate where God is present and active in the world today? What is God about these days in the world? That's the question for Thursday. For Friday, it's a question of what does God know? Does God know everything? We could perhaps say that God knows everything about the past and God knows everything about the present, but does God know everything about the future? Now, I suspect that most of you, of course. Well, maybe some of the biblical materials will challenge us a little bit at that point to see whether God does in fact know everything about the future. And what effect will it have upon our thinking about the faith if in fact God doesn't know everything about the future? And that will lead us into Saturday morning this week. We'll talk about God of the future. Is the future all locked up for God? Is it possible that God can be affected in certain ways so that the future of the world is somewhat indeterminate at the present time? That what you and I say and do will affect not only the future of the world, but the future of God? And we want to talk a little bit about prophecy in that, too. What does, a lot of stuff about Hal Lindsey and the future of the late great planet Earth, that sort of thing. How might we relate to that kind of talk about the future? Well, that's the rest of this week. Some materials about God and the Old Testament texts, then that we'll be in and out of to try to get some handles on those topics. I'm going to ask you to take a moment here to begin with for a little exercise and ask you all to close your eyes. And I'd like to have you picture in your mind's eye who or what God is. Who or what is God for you? What images come to mind? What words would depict the God whom you see in your mind's eye? Is there a face there? What expression, if there's a face there, what expression is on the face?
Suffering.
Let the questions be rhetorical initially, if I can, then we'll get back to talk about them, okay? Now put this image of God in the world somewhere. Just pick any setting, put it in the world somewhere. Where is God in the world that you have now? Is it in Holden Village? Or is it your own home? Or does God remain out there in the clouds somewhere yet? You are asked to paint that picture on the ceiling of a modern Sistine Chapel. What would it look like? Well, open your eyes. Let's just have you reflect a little bit on what you thought about as I continue to talk and come back to it. Were there any military associations at all associated with that picture? General Patton, perhaps? Was it, in fact, the God of Michelangelo? The God that Michelangelo painted on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel is one of the few attempts to draw a picture of God. We've got all kinds of pictures of Jesus, but not many of God on the part of the famous painters. Was it like Michelangelo? If you've been there, it'll never leave you. Kind of a stern, creative, forbidding picture of God with that finger reaching out and the Adam's finger reaching toward. Was your God the chairman of the board type? One who would lead an excellent committee meeting or something. What is your god a Charles Atlas figure? No. Muscles. Or if not muscles, the equivalent thereof. Was it a male god? Were the features of your god decisively male? Is it possible if there's anyone in the group for which they were decisively female? Or was it gender neutral? Was your god a virile god, a macho god? Superman out there anywhere? Was your god a buddy-buddy god? Was it my god and I walk through the fields and forests together kind of god? How many of you pictured Jesus? How many of you thought of that?
I think a picture of Jesus was the only thing I could really get a handle on.
Okay. Well, let's hold those now for a minute.
One question.
Yeah?
What did you mean when you asked the question, where is God? You didn't answer that one.
No, right. We've got mostly questions yet here. and where is God is we're going to talk about tomorrow and the next day. I'm going to put you off on that. And tomorrow, today we're going to do some, that's one of the questions. Where is God? Where in the world is God? Let me back up and talk a little bit about what drives me to these questions. I come at it from the perspective of one whose field is Old Testament. And I'm amazed at how negative the Old Testament God is commonly viewed. God is a God of judgment. God is a God of wrath. He's distant. The thunder and lightning bolt kind of God. Law, judgment. A lot of bad press for the Old Testament God, but it's amazing that most of the resources for the Christian understanding of God are to be found in the Old Testament. It's not often that you find New Testament materials being dealt with at any length and talking about God. Some of that work going on, but not a great deal. I think the typical perspective on God from an Old Testament perspective would be that which was brought out by David Frost, and maybe you remember David Frost in some of the interviews on his talk shows. He once interviewed the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he asked the Archbishop to describe God. And the Archbishop came forth with these beautiful words: "Something within one and beyond one that fills one with awe and reverence and gives one a sense of supreme obligation." And at that point, David Frost interrupted the comment, "That could be the Internal Revenue Service." I find it very interesting it'll be interesting to see what you have later, but that among many people, there's no face on God. God is vaguely abstract. Why is that so? When the biblical materials are absolutely filled with that which is formful and concrete, where the metaphors are all living. A second factor which brings me into this discussion is more personal. Give you some idea of some of the roots here. I grew up in a very pietistic home. My grandfather was a Haugianer preacher. Some of you know what that is, from the old Haugi branch of the Lutheran Church. My mother and my father came through the LBI in the cities way back in the 1930s, which had a certain pietism. Among other experiences, one forever imprinted on my memory is when my grandfather took my wife and I out to a crowded restaurant on Chicago Avenue in Minneapolis. I think we were married 1 year or something like that. And the place was jammed with people, and we were sitting at a table out in the middle of everything. And our meal came, And he began to pray out loud. And slowly sit there and move down underneath the table. But having finished his prayer, that wasn't enough. Then he began to sing. And he sang this song: Jesus never fails, Jesus never fails. Heaven and earth may pass away, but Jesus never fails. The place was death, you know? Quiet, and I was almost under the table. I don't know about faith, brother. But that kind of pietism, needing to be to share one's faith out in the open like that, and in those kinds of ways, it's less embarrassing to me these days, I think, than it was back then. But and I look back on it with much more fondness, I think. But the pietistic notion of God, which was so much a part of that perspective, but so often unexamined, but it's occasioned much thought for me in recent years. God always seems so close. So close. The prayers of my parents assume that God is so much at hand, so ready to respond. And God is a responsive God. That's the word that describes him. Responsive. One's prayers can affect God. They can move God. And that just is a matter of course, I think, in the prayers of my parents. I think about those prayers every day at home. Free prayers, long prayers. But what kind of God must God be if he could be so affected? Is it just possible that the God of my pietistic forebears is much closer to the biblical picture of God than it is to some of the notions that are out and about in the life of the church in more recent generations? Well, that's a question with which I live, and it's a question with which I would like to work with you over the next days. What kind of God do you believe in? What kind of God do you believe in? What kind of God is the biblical God? It's not enough to say that you believe in God. All kinds of atrocities have been committed by people who say that they believe in God, from the Inquisition to Jonestown. People who confess belief in God. The key question is, what kind of God is your God? What images come to your mind when you think about God? It's said, without going into metaphors here in any detail, it's said that metaphors, and that's really the basic language we have to work with when we talk about God. We're working with pictures, images, metaphors. Metaphors have a capacity not simply to shape your thinking about something, but to shape your life. That they work deeply into yourself and shape your will, your emotions. If God is primarily judge for you, if courtroom images, gavel, judgments come to mind fundamentally in your thinking about God, then chances are pretty great that you yourself will be judgmental. That those images of God have a capacity to shape your life so that what you think about God begins to shape you. And in fact, it can tend to shape one toward unbelief. Let me read you a little quote from a book by a preacher's kid. I sympathize with this. Thomas Matthews. He's an American journalist and critic, written a book entitled Under the Influence, and he is really no longer a part of the Christian tradition, though he grew up within it. Try as I may, I cannot altogether shake off my habitual awe of the church, nor completely dissociate it from the far more fearful God to whom the church makes its ritual obeisance. I still think of God, no, not think, but apprehend, as I was trained as a child to envision him, as a watchful, vengeful, enormous, omniscient policeman. Instantly aware of the slightest tinge of irreverence in my innermost thought, always ready to pounce if I curse, if I mention him in anger, fun, or mere habit, though with ominous patience he might hold his hand for a time. But how can that kind of fear of that kind of God be the beginning of wisdom? All too often, I think, the church becomes concerned, or has become concerned, with the question of whether you believe in God. I think that finally is rather, it's inconsequential question in many ways. Church just has to go on to talk about the kind of God in whom one believes. Now let's take a look at that a little bit more at metaphor. One of the predominant metaphors used for God is Father. Might be a good example to use to talk about how our individual and social experience has gone to shape the way in which we unpack a metaphor like that. God is Father. Your experience with your own father will shape in rather decisive ways how you think about God when he, notice that, is referred to as Father. A person with a brutal father or a person with an incestuous father will think of God as Father with far different eyes and ears than I will. But your own experience with Father is going to affect inevitably how you hear that language. One of my concerns is that the church has a rather restricted, rather narrow group number of images which it uses to talk about God. And if Father is one of them, as I suspect it is, then I think it's quite possible that we are using language for God that strikes at some of the worst experiences in the life of people. And that their relationship with God is affected adversely as a consequence. My concern is that we expand the metaphors that we use to talk about God. In the book of Psalms alone, there are over 50 different metaphors used to speak of God. Why do we get along with a relatively few number of them? So, now, in our culture today, there are there's what we might call a metaphoric shift going on in talk about God. One of the areas of thought is feminism. It's very much a part of the educational life, educational institutions of the part of the country from which I come, certainly. But they are, the women of the church in particular, are asking us to think clearly about the issue of God from the perspective of male and female. And there is a decisive shift going on so that, for example, I wrote a book for Abingdon Press, published last year, and I was really rather careful in my language that I used to talk about God. But the editor went through and took out every masculine metaphor to refer to God, that I used to refer to God. So that there is now in that book not one single pronoun for God. That is the direction in which we're going. So that maleness, femaleness, becomes a very lively issue in how we view or think about God. Part of our culture, it'll become increasingly so. The more that women become a part of the clergy of the church, the more that women become conscious of the simple failure on the part of male leadership to be cognizant of the feminine imagery for God in the Bible. Another thing that's a part of our culture are the liberation theologies of various kinds. One could put feminist theology in that, of course, but let's take others, black theology, etc. What images for God are at stake here? If you have an image for God as master or Lord, what is the image for the human if God is master? Slave. King, subject. What now are we going to do with those images which lift up a relationship where the human side of it tends to be seen in a subservient sense? I think that these liberation theologies are forcing us to think anew about the impact of the overuse of certain such metaphors for God, and whether they have not had a negative impact upon the society of which we are a part, promoting inequities in our relationships with others. Or take the peace issue. A very powerful movement within this country and others, having lived in England recently for a year, the women of Grenham Common, for example. What do you do with the images in the scriptures of God as a warrior? God who leads the armies into battle. Has that image been in fact a very powerful one in the life not only of the church, the culture, making it difficult for us to lift up peace issues in the way in which they ought to be lifted up? And now with the increasing cultural awareness of the importance of those issues, how is that going to affect the way in which we talk about God? Or when the culture has also lifted up, back to that. Recent experiences in war, Second World War in particular, and the Holocaust, with the massacre of millions of Jews and others, have thrown into a cocked hat certain understandings of God as impassable. As to say, of God who is one who is unaffected by what happens in the life of the world. If God is unaffected by the killing of all those people in the Second World War, then how can that God be my God? That's the question. And so what do you do with some of the old language to talk about God, that God is immutable, God is impassible in the face of such horror? So we need to go back to the scriptures. What kind of God is evident there? Are there images that might be of help in talking about a God who lives through such experiences as the Holocaust? How, in fact, does God respond to such events as those? So those are just a few of the contemporary issues that are forcing what we might call a metaphoric shift in our thinking about God. And the biblical resources that we have available to us have not been dealt with at any great breadth or depth in recent years to respond to these cultural metaphoric shifts. One of the concerns then that I will want to be about in these sessions together is then the images or the metaphors that we use to speak of God, how we picture God, and what help they might be to us in the life of the church. Because I think that the way in which we view God will be basically the way in which we shape our lives. That's enough for me now. Comments, questions. Let's come back to your thinking a little bit about those moments that you took to talk about it, to think about God. What's out there? Let's hear it.
Are there any neutral metaphors that don't have a negative side that are come to your mind right now, or you don't want to do that right now?
A neutral metaphor, that's it. Okay, what do you mean though?
Well, it's like father has its negative connotations, judge has its negative connotations. Everything seems to have had its negative, as you've been mentioning.
How about God is rock? Would that help? That falls on you and breaks your neck.
Immutable.
Right. Well, let me suggest that I think that there is, in fact, no metaphor that does not is not capable of being pushed in negative directions. Okay. What do we need? We need not only to have an expanded number of metaphors among us, which we can draw on, but we need what I would call a controlling metaphor, or controlling metaphors, in order to handle some of these. For example, father. You need to have, alongside a father, love. God is a loving father always. You can't let father operate by itself because of all the various impacts that can have. Or God is a mother who will never forget her children, Isaiah 49, who will never forget, ever. So you take that basic metaphor and you have controlling metaphors which help you talk about or which inform other metaphors. And where do the controlling metaphors come from? Well, they come out of basic creedal statements which the Old Testament has to say. The Lord our God is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. Those are our controlling metaphors, which must be used always to talk about some of these more picturesque metaphors. So I think we're stuck. I don't think there's any neutral one there.
Well, I was just aware that I guess the word used Christ, Jesus, as a buffering. When I hear father, because I knew growing up that father in heaven was not the same as my father and fathers around me, that Christ was the buffer, and he made that father in heaven the loving father. So therefore I would never think of my father as like Godfather, because
okay.
I knew that he was human.
That's interesting, and I think helpful. But it's also interesting to me that the shift you made, you went, rather than think of God as one, the loving father who sent Jesus, you move from Jesus back to God.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
One used last night was creator. There was a switch, in fact, from the language in the Green Book already. They've dropped. There was a reference to God the Father.
Yep.
And Elmer used creator. Isn't that a
neutral?
Gender unspecific?
That was for Father.
There are a couple of issues here that are problematic, and Elmer's not here to talk about that. The Trinitarian formula is a special problem. God, that fatherhood in that case refers to the relationship between God and Jesus. And to play around with Trinitarian formula is, I think, not very helpful. Speak of God as creator. Jesus, first chapter of the Gospel of John confesses Jesus as creator. We speak about Spiritus Creator, the Holy Spirit is creator. We're all over the place immediately. Once you start talking about function.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think the best help I have is that when you say anything about God, you're limiting God.
Okay.
Any one thing, right?
What metaphors always have, that's very important. On the one hand, the temptation is to talk about metaphors literally. God, I mean, the closest we get to this is in Daniel 7, where you get an old man with a white beard on your hands. But to make all these metaphors literal will get you into all kinds of trouble, because if God is husband to Israel, to people who are wife, and if God is father to people who are children, I mean, you mix those metaphors and you're in some kind of trouble. So no literalness here. On the other hand, the other danger is to suggest that there's no essential continuity between the metaphor that you're using and God as he really is. That's equally dangerous. That's as idolatrous as the other side. Metaphors are reality depicting. They do say something about God as God really is. But at the same time, they don't say everything, or they don't say enough. And so you always have, when working with a metaphor, you say not only what it says positively, but, well, what it doesn't say. You have to say, well, God is, well, let me give you an example. God's eyes and ears are referred to all over the Old Testament, for example. On the positive side of that, to speak about God's eyes and ears is really fascinating, because that suggests that God takes the world into himself in as real a way as people do with their eyes and ears. But the metaphor is inadequate at a couple of points, because God takes the whole world in. Huh? No, people do. So that immediately, your metaphor immediately breaks down at that point. Also, God doesn't have fleshly eyes and ears, so the metaphor breaks down at that point. So yes and no.
You mentioned various religious leaders, you can't bear your own father, and you mentioned Billy Graham. Can you describe for us, in your own mind, what is the idea that Billy Graham has of God that drives him on his mission that he's on?
I don't know about Billy Graham's idea of God so much. My guess is that Graham's idea of God is really highly traditional. It's a picture of God which would kind of fits a typical churchly perspective. And so all the words that you'd hear about omnipotent, omniscient, immutable, holy, just, etc., would apply. I think there's probably nothing special about Billy Graham's view of God, in terms of, other than the fact that it's unless traditional is special. Mike, I've not read enough of Graham to be able to speak more than that. Yes?
I'm just wondering often, because like in the Old Testament, some of the images of God that are portrayed, I cannot understand or identify with, you know. I have a hard time with the Psalms sometimes. It's like, whose God is that God?
Yep.
You know, but do these images come from humankind, some kind of image that they put upon God? Were those images really from God, say, think of me in this way at this time of this century, no. Is that too much to ask?
Well, I don't think that's too much to ask. I don't know about the answer, but I think it works both ways. I think the biblical material would suggest that God has given certain individuals insights into who he is and what he is. On the other hand, in human experience, occasions certain thought about who God is. It works both and back and forth. I suppose go back into see some of the Moses materials in particular, where you could get God revealing himself. But let's take the Genesis material. Human beings are created in the image of God, it says. Now, we can't spend much time on what the image of God is all about. But some recent scholars recently have suggested that we've looked at that passage about the image of God 180 degrees from the way in which it should be looked at. We've suggested that that passage says, well, that human beings are, in some respects at least, like God. But really what the passage says is that I got that turned around, didn't I? Many times, much of the language we use to talk about God, this is the traditional way of thinking, but much of the language we use to talk about God is simply a taking of human characteristics and sort of jacking them up to the maximum possible. So you think about God as having certain human characteristics. But actually that passage is suggesting that human beings are in fact shaped in the image of God. We don't think of God as if he were a human being, but human beings themselves have been shaped in the likeness of God. You move the other way. That's an interesting direction to take with that passage, and suggesting that we do have many continuities between God and human beings that we need to talk about in a helpful way. I think it would be helpful in our thinking about God. I don't know if you want to push that question a little bit further. I think it moves both ways. God reveals some things, gives some insights. Human beings, on the basis of their experience, move the other way. Maybe I could make one other comment. Metaphors function at least three different levels. You have what you might call excellent metaphors. They're full of life. They're capable of extrapolation in all sorts of directions. God is parent, for example. You can move with parent all over the place. On the other hand, it's very difficult to move with, say, the image in Hosea 5 as God is dry rot. I mean, you don't have much room to maneuver on that one. You can't think. It doesn't spark your imagination to think about possibilities of relationships there. A rather more intermediate category might be God as rock. That's a rather limited metaphor, even. So their metaphors have different depth and breadth to them. And biblical writers, I think Hosea uses dry rot and moth. God is a moth. I think he uses those metaphors for their surprise value. What was that again? Huh? I mean, and there's some interesting ways in which preachers can use those surprise metaphors, because they occasion thinking in people's minds in ways the ordinary wouldn't. So that would be another way of moving into what you see in the text. Some of them are surprise metaphors and are intended to, what is that all about? Get you to think.
What's wrong with looking at God the way what we know of Jesus, the way he presented his Father?
Okay, the suggestion is that Jesus' own picturing of God is the most helpful way of thinking about God. I think that that's really a helpful way into the whole subject. We do say that Jesus came to reveal God to us. He made such statements as, he who has seen me has seen the Father. All that the Father has is mine. But I suspect that when you picture God in your mind, how many here thought of Jesus immediately? I'm curious. How many thought of Jesus? Well, maybe 25% of you or less.
Can I ask a quick question there, since you were on that subject? Why did we all assume that it was God's direction that Jesus came to earth? We all believe that. Why did he come as a man, and why did he come as a woman?
That is really a tough question. I don't know the answer to that. That's one of the first questions I have for God when I get there. If anything, I suspect it would be a question that would be something like, well, in that day and age, if it had been a woman, the culture was such that it would have been impossible for Jesus to have made the kind
Can
of
Can I answer that in my own way?
Sure. Yeah.
When we read the Old Testament, the man was the leader of the household. The woman was very low, even much lower than she is today. And I don't think the people of Israel would have understood if he came to the woman. They just wouldn't have understood. They weren't ready for it.
I think, though, it is amazing that the Old Testament people, it's not as patriarchal as you might think. Why is it, for example, in the fourth commandment, it doesn't just say honor your father, it says honor your father and your mother? And there are surprising passages like that out and about in the Old Testament material. And as I mentioned, quite a few passages which talk about God in feminine terms. Feminine metaphors are there. And so I think that what's happened is that by and large, the church in subsequent centuries has lifted up the male side of God and has tended to ignore the resources that are in fact in the biblical materials for talking about God in more comprehensive terms.
Yeah. One could think that all these metaphors that there are for God confuse as well as enlighten. Why is all of our, or so much of our God talk metaphoric, and why don't we talk more instead of God is like, and just ask or say God is, and try to speak more of God's essence? Why is that so hard for us? Why do we use so much metaphor in talking of God?
I don't think we have an alternative, really.
Well, that's what I'm...
I wonder, give us a...
Well,
start us out in a conversation that would not be metaphoric to talk about God.
Well, that's what I say. If you say biblical, God is love, God is spirit, God is truth, are those all?
Sure, there. It's all metaphor. The only thing I can think of right offhand that would not be metaphor would probably be the word God itself. I think that's the language that we're using, that we talk about, in talking about God. And, I don't think that we have any other alternative. That's not to suggest, as I mentioned earlier, that metaphor, there isn't an essential continuity between the metaphor and God as he really is. But there's always a no to every metaphor.
Well, God as he really is, how do you get at that without?
Well, I think that you only get at that insofar as your metaphor enables you to, you know, to push in that direction in some ways. You interpret along the grain of a metaphor, or you interpret along the basic thrust of a metaphor to try to get at the reality which is God. God is love. But then you try to unpack love. And then you run into problems.
I think it's good to have all these metaphors, because isn't God, God to me is just everything, everything good. And every metaphor has some good in it and not all of my bad, but I think this is good, because God is everything. It's just like a big overwhelming sky, and you have all those metaphors that kind of cling to him because he is so good.
That is a big overwhelming sky. I mean, you just come across Montana.
I was raised in North Dakota.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. That's what you were picturing in your mind. Was there any form at all to God? It was just sky.
I think that he was there, but I didn't see any form of this. Then I go back to the Washington mist, and it's kind of mist over here. Everything isn't so clear, so it doesn't have to be so clear, as long as you know that there is a God, and that he is a wonderful God.
Okay. Yes?
Do you think a lot of our use of metaphors and whatnot is... caused by the fact that was one of the predominant forms of communication back
when the Old Testament and the New Testament were being written, people talked in parables, they talked in metaphors. And do you think that that has shaped the way that we speak about God and understand God? Because so much of the Bible, the Bible is written in that context.
I would hope to say that metaphor has been one of the most basic ingredients of human language and human communication in all centuries, not just in biblical centuries. I think, I guess I would just make that claim, and that we can move through the poets and the novelists and the painters, et cetera, and try to unpack that. But one of the interesting aspects of your question is would be this, whether there are, I mean, certain metaphors die. Certain metaphors are not able to function anymore because the culture has become, such that they don't live in the way they used to. And new metaphors can be born. I thought God is a great computer. No, that is a metaphor. The computer is a metaphoric resource for us. Is it helpful at all? I mean, we have to ask that question. Is it helpful at all to talk about God? So cultures are constantly kicking up new possibilities for talk about God.
But I was thinking more of the parables where relating things by telling stories is a unique art these days, whereas it was a predominant form of communication in biblical days. Now, somebody's really unique if they're a storyteller today in our culture. That's really something unusual. But in those days, that was one of the predominant ways of talking.
I wonder if you're not selling our culture short there.
Perhaps. We're just looking at my perspective.
I know quite a few excellent storytellers, but they don't write or.
Well, sure, but they are unique. Yeah. And well, they're unique in our culture.
Okay. My guess is that the other side of it would be that in biblical times, not all were capable of telling stories equally well. There probably wasn't any higher percentage of that population that was capable of doing stories well.
Except that was one of the ways of passing. There were nothing being printed. That was one of the ways of passing down your culture from one generation to the next with storytelling. So it was more important.
Yeah. Right.
I've just come from a couple family reunions. And we told the old stories.
Yeah.
And it was grand.
Yeah.
It was grand. Ed and I had to put up with it. That's. I think it's alive and well. That's why I mentioned at breakfast. I think you're thinking of Garrison Keillor.
Yes.
And I think we'll have to get Garrison Keillor into a Seattle station.
Yeah.
He is.
Yeah.
KUOW.
There you go. 3:15. No, it'll be 4:15.
No, it's at 5:00. 5:07 on Saturday. Oh,
they delay it then.
They said it's not important in my culture.
Oh, it should be.
He's Irish, actually, so it's not Norwegian.
Storytelling. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I was going to say, do you think that maybe it's just that our brains, like physiologically, are limited? God is too complex that we could never really understand it and pin it down into something that isn't just sort of frustrating for us, like it's just a step in learning that is too hard for the human brain, and maybe we won't ever really grasp it. Or do some people get to the point where God is easy for them to understand?
No, God is never easy. Mm-hmm. God outdistances all of our images. But just because that is so, because there will always be a certain element of frustration in all our talk about the faith which is ours, whether it be God or other aspects of it, I think that should drive us on to a further understanding rather than to make this sort of so we sit back and just say, well, I can't really get very far with this, I'll just give up. Jesus promised that the Holy Spirit would come to lead us into all the truth. And I must, one of the things that I believe to be the case about that promise of Jesus is that he asks us to use the best minds that we have available to us and, to probe into the meaning of the faith which is ours. Yes?
I'd like to suggest also that our images and metaphors of God are very culturally, predominantly cultural. there are in other cultures, especially cultures that have to do, which are very closely associated with the religion, Hinduism and Buddhism. Their cultures also bring forth many, many rich metaphors and images of God, many of which have to do with more matriarchal or maternal instincts and metaphors.
Yeah. I think that's one of the exciting things about the extension of the church into different parts of the world in the last century, is that I think that there's going to be a metaphoric extension here.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued particularly about what I see in Japan, and if there's anybody here who's spent some time in Japan and thought through some of that material, I'd love to be able to talk with you about it, because we're going to be going to Japan in December for just a bit and work with some of these very matters.
Yeah.
But I'm struck by the fact that the image of Father in Japan is apparently very, very low in terms of its capability of insight, and that the mother images are much more capable of conveying a depth and breadth, and that Shusaku Endo, for example, wrote The Silence, makes the claim that one of the reasons why Christianity has not made the kind of impact in the Japanese culture that it has in other cultures is simply because the Father image is so predominant. And so that's it.
And the Christian Church has tried to implant and to force upon other cultures most of the metaphors that we have in our Western culture.
And I think a very limited find of them.
Yes.
Perhaps.
Yes. And this has changed also in the last 10 or 15 years as far as missiology of the church is concerned.
Yeah. Well, we have just a minute left, and so tomorrow we start getting into texts and probe some of the detail associated with this more general discussion that we've had today. Thank you very much. I look forward to our time together.
Thank you.